welcome to Chai with Samdosa. In my episodes, I have a great heart-centered conversation with my guests. They are in a diverse population around the world. So enjoy and have lots of fun. Please get in touch if you'd like to be on my podcast as well. Bye for now. Welcome to Chai with Samdosa. It's a sunny, bright day in UK, and weekend is all here. Looking forward to be enjoying the weekend. So today I got a very amazing guest all the way from New Zealand. He is an aesthetic, and his whole life is spent in that sort of a profession. Still great recoverer from alcoholic as well, which is another area, because sometimes we will feel that professions which is looked at as a great professions, people do go into great challenges in their life, but they come out from those sort of challenges as well. So Stephen Knapp is an aesthetic from New Zealand, and he is on his journey, and he's working towards some amazing challenges, or I would say adventures instead of challenges, which he has greatly appreciated and moving on right now. So why don't we welcome Stephen Knapp from New Zealand. Welcome, Stephen.
Thank you so much, Sam, for having me on your show. It is an honor, and I hope I can share some of the insights and some of the lessons I've learned the hard way with your listeners and viewers, so that they don't have to make the same mistakes.
True, very true. So this podcast is all about heart-centered conversation with my guests, and it's called Chai with Samdosa. And Stephen, go and tell my audience who Stephen is and what is his purpose right now.
Well, that's the exciting part. The exciting part is that I am a man who has fought many demons in his life. And I was a man in the past who had very few coping strategies. My main crutch was indeed alcohol. And with that, I was trying to placate and treat whatever came my way, let it be acute challenges, let it be depression, let it be post-traumatic stress disorder. Whatever was hitting me, alcohol was my supposed friend. That was pretty much my part, or my life, shall I say, until about 7 years ago, when I hit rock bottom and when enough was truly enough. At that time, my wife, behind my back, organized a stint in a rehabilitation hospital. And it was the start of a journey that led me from an empty shell to now a man who has abundant energy and who lives such a beautiful, beautiful life that yesterday is jealous of today. Oh, it wow. Is just amazing. Yeah, I love my life with every second, every challenge, every opportunity, everything that comes my way.
Amazing, amazing. Looking at the new you and looking at the future or present where you are in here is a blessing. And when you surrounded by right people, and as you said, you know, your wife actually helped you to go through with your journey, because we found a lot of challenges, or I would say adventures, in our life where we have not many people hold our hand to pull us out. I just want to share this joke here while we are on that. We all go through our life journeys and adventures, but there are very few people comes in our life, who wants to hold our hand. And so this is a time when everybody has been completely dead. So if we are looking at, we are in, whether it's heaven or hell, whatever we call it. So there are a lot of big holes everywhere. And each hole, there are two guards are standing with a spike. And nobody can come out from those holes. One of the hole is without any guards. And everybody wonders, why is that? And that dedicated hole is for those people, for those individual souls where there are other souls are sitting there who are pulling their legs. So they don't want them to go out. So there is already people sitting there who are pulling their legs so they can't come out. So you can imagine in our life, in our adventures, there are so many people who does not want us to rise above. And those are the ones which we need to cut our shackles from those people. And that's where we started to go into a challenge or journeys going ahead of ourselves. So,
but that, of course, is exactly the problem with alcoholics. Because we alcoholics, we deep inside know that it's probably not normal that you drink a whole bottle of vodka in a setting. So we don't like to remind ourselves. So what do? We find friends that are coming along on the right, that are just as much alcoholics as we are. So they have a bottle of whatever it is, their poison, and I've got my bottle, and we all get drunk and we all have a good time and brilliant. And then we're unconscious, and then we wake up with a hangover, don't know what we have done, but we all do the same thing. So therefore it becomes absolutely normal for you. Mm-hmm. You do no longer consider it anything abnormal. So it is a tricky one, because when you start your recovery process, one of the very first things you find is that so-called friends are no longer your friends. And it turns out that these friends are typically drinking partners rather than anything else.
That's true. So your book, which you talk about in your videos and your podcasts and other things about, how do you pronounce it?
My Steps to Sobriety.
Sobriety,
The title, that's right. It's the title of my book.
Yeah. So give us a little bit about your book, as how that has evolved in this whole journey.
Well, as I said, I started with an empty shell because I was working 16, 18-hour days. And when I was not working, I was drinking. And so that was defining my whole life. When I went into recovery and came out, suddenly there was no more drinking. And the position, the job that I held, I had to give up. Because it was destroying me. I was giving too much of my heart away for my patients in that setting. So that I left the field of chronic pain medicine, and I became what I was initially starting out with, a normal anesthetist who takes care of patients whilst they're having surgery. But when you asked me, or had you asked me then, who are you? And in fact, psychologists and counselors have asked me, you know, who is the real Stefan Neff? Mm-hmm. I had actually no answer whatsoever. So I started doing the tiny little steps, the things that you need to do to actually rebuild yourself. And I'll talk a lot in my book about these micro habits of adding a routine to your day, making sure you're eating, making sure you're actually getting up and you're getting to bed in a timely fashion. Make sure you've got some exercise, the appropriate nutrition. Make sure you learn something creative, you learn something emotional, etc. So there are a lot of little steps I have taken. And with that, slowly but surely, a new me arose, literally like the phoenix out of the ashes. It was really only after 2-3 years of being sober that I started really to develop the joy that I nowadays have in such abundance. So, and during these next 3-4 years, people were looking at me and said, wow, Stefan, you did really so well. And by the way, I've got a friend who is really in trouble. Would you mind maybe having a little chat or so? So I became on a one-to-one level, I became a little bit of an eye-opener for them, just sharing some of the things that I did and my journey. I gave a few lectures within my hospital. So I was not hiding my past, but at the same token, I was not going out there onto the rooftops and shouting out for everyone to hear, hey, I'm Stefan, I'm an alcoholic. Having said that, by the end of last year, my wife actually looked at me and asked me, why don't you write a book about your experience? You've had such a tremendous journey and you've learned so much. Why not share that with a wider audience? And initially it was a bit scary, I must admit. And so I slept on it and then started tentatively writing. And before I knew it, I couldn't stop writing. And it was just coming out like a creative explosion out of my fingertips. And it's just writing. And initially it was quite a dark book, because I remembered a lot of the bad things and I've put them all into the book. And yes, out of each of these dark episodes are of course lessons learned, etc. So it made sense then. And I gave the very first draft to my mentor, to the director of the rehabilitation hospital, which had saved my life. So I gave it to him and he read it and thought, really, really good. Thank you very much. But you know, people will read this book. They don't want to have the guts and the blood and the pain to that degree. They have that in their own life. What they want is the solution. They want to see where can you go and how do you get there? And when he told me that, I started looking at the book in a new light. And it became less of an autobiography, but more of an more carefully tuned book that is more focused on what you can actually achieve and how you achieve it, rather than look what I did when I was drunk. Because there are so many stories out there. Crikey. And you guys, I mean, those of you who are listening or finding themselves listening suddenly with high attention to this podcast, it probably means that I'm triggering something in you. And no doubt there will be flashbacks, immediate memories, probably hazy memories of something you have done under the influence. There will be shame, guilt, all these negative emotions there. They might start bubbling to the surface whilst we're talking here. And that is probably a good thing that it does happen, because we all have got our demons. We all have got our darkness. And most of us don't really know so well how to deal with that. I certainly had no clue what to do. These emotions, those funny things that happen below the cortex of my brain at the reptilian level, my goodness, I had no idea. I mean, I experienced them, the rage, the hatred, the resentment, all those nasty, powerful emotions that really can put a dampener on your day or really make you do stupid things, especially when you add it with alcohol. You know, you might recall the best email that you've ever regretted. We sometimes drink and dial, or drink and write. And my goodness, the amount of emails that I would have loved to suck back from the internet. Oh my goodness. So we all have been there. We all have done bad things, dark things, some darker than others, but rest assured, virtually everyone who is listening will recognize him or herself in my words. But I just want to tell you, hey, this is not a life sentence. Just because you've stuffed up in the past, however royally you stuffed up, that was the past. The past doesn't equal the future. Right now, you make a choice of listening to Sam's podcast. Mm-hmm. So right now, you're making a positive choice there. Yes, you might have a glass of something in your hand. That's another story. That's a story for another day. Well, you might.
That's true, Stefan. Because a lot of things people go through in their life and trying to overcome in different areas of their life. As you said, you know, sometimes we are going through at this present moment. We are going through a pandemic around the globe, and a lot of people are going through with some significant challenges in their life at the moment. Not every household has the same story. Not every Stefan or Sam has the same story, because we are all going through a certain degree of completely different adventures in our life. And you can't say, okay, Sam is laughing, or Sam is happy, or Stefan is happy, then they are in a very good space. Yeah, we are. This is our own way of looking at life. You can't look at perceive things in your own periphery vision, how you look at things in life. Because if I would say that, oh yeah, I am content and I am happy, does not mean that everything is hunky-dory. It might be my way of emotionally containing myself is different. The way I look at life is different. And Stefan has gone through with his own journey, and now he look at the life is completely different, because he know the essence of what is more important in life. So everybody goes through with their own journey. When you talk about habits in your book, as well as your own journey, how much weight you will put on habits when you are going through with this whole scenario?
Hugely. It is the micro habits that will define you and will put you into an autopilot to create a good day. The saying is that if you don't work on your recovery, you're working on your relapse. And the working on recovery means that you follow your micro habits, whatever version of them fits for you. There was a beautiful TEDx talk from a admiral who emphasizes the importance of getting up and making your bed. And it is a very powerful, powerful thing, because he says, look, you know, when you're coming home at night, you know, it is already, the bed is made, etc. And you start making this bed, and it is something that sets you on the right path every day. And it is as simple and as beautiful as that, that gets you going. For other people, it's not the making of the bed. For other people, it might be that they stop, press the pause button for a moment when they get up, and think, what am I grateful and happy for? So to actually use a minute of thinking and spelling it out and speaking out loud, I am happy and grateful that I can sit here, that I'm not in a country that is burning with civil war, but I can sit here and I actually feel alive, and in a moment I will go downstairs and we'll have a lovely coffee. I'm really grateful that I have got the money to buy me this coffee. Full stop. It's as simple as that. That just came out of my mouth without me thinking. I was just expressing my gratitude. Yet that little bit, those 30 seconds, 60 seconds, change your whole makeup inside. So one little habit of spending 1 minute out of these 18 minutes, or how many it is in a day, is such a powerful thing. It's beautiful. And then this is one habit. And you start another, that you actually make a point of having a breakfast, in which you start looking at, I want to actually feed myself, my body, but I also want to feed my spirit and my mind. So you might look at your meal with gratitude again. You might look at the beautiful colors, because you know that what you're eating there, maybe some blueberries or something else, is very healthy to you. So you're actually getting this positive vibe. I'm actually looking after myself. And that's, again, is a very positive thing. You wash it down with a glass of water. Now you know you're rehydrated. So it's the tiny little things. Because if you do that, you might not find huge breakthroughs in whatever happens to you. No. But what happens if you don't do that? I'll give you an example. If I want to create a relapse for myself, I only need to do four things. I need to be hungry, angry, lonely, tired. If I haven't eaten the whole day, or if I'm thirsty, that sets me up the wrong way. Angry, emotionally unstable, etc. Whoa, that is a good trigger for me. Lonely, sad, depressed, no one loves me, pity party. Tired, because I've, again, have been working too much, even if it is fun things that I did, but now I'm tired. Bring those four together, and I could open a bottle of wine right here, right now, despite the fact that I am 2,324 days sober. But it is, I have let my guard slip. I have not obeyed the basic principles of keeping myself happy and healthy, and now I'm paying the price for it. And alcohol is sneaky. We alcoholics, God, we love that drink. God, and it doesn't matter how long you've been sober, the temptation is always there. And when I say alcoholic, that was my chosen poison. There are many, many other addictions out there. There's the opiate epidemic in the United States as a very pronounced thing. But there are so many other addictions, from gambling to eating disorders to sex pornography to you name it. There are so many things out there where essentially we are expressing the same behavior regardless of what we have chosen. It's the same exaggerated dopamine response that we are craving. We want that super high.
Yeah, that's quite interesting. The addiction of things take you to a completely different level of your journey. Same as when people are saying that there was a study done in America about two cases in two different subjects. One was a person with cocaine, which means that they were having a specifically something happening in their mind when they're having a cocaine snort into their nose, and this goes into this one part of their brain was activated completely. And then they actually seen same result to an executive who was craving for more money. So he said, they said they've seen this exactly the same thing, that he had a one mansion or a jet, and he was craving for another mansion, another jet. So that was exactly the trigger happening in his head as well, the same thing which was happening in the person who was snorting the cocaine. So they said this is also an addiction of having more than what end up you is completely devastate your life, and you end up killing yourself, I would say, because you can't control it. Correct? You can't control it, and that's what happened.
I would say you can control it if you're learning what to do, if you're developing the mindfulness and the insight that you're able to step outside of your body and observe what is actually right now happening. The hungry, angry, lonely, tired, halt. That was such a powerful mnemonic for me in the first year or two, because suddenly I would be driving home and in my mind, I was already planning to go somewhere and buy myself a bottle of wine. And I caught myself and I was getting angry with myself and thought, why, come on, you're 6 months sober and now suddenly your mind wants to buy a bottle of wine? Are you crazy? And it was that hold there. So there will always be triggers and there will always be something there. And I think it's really important for your listeners to realize that addiction is actually very, very common. you're talking 1 in 5, 1 in 3 people, somewhere in between there. That is the incidence of chemical addiction out there. What does that mean? What happens in our brains if you're an addict and you get your chosen fix? Is that it might be an opiate, it might be alcohol, that might be your adrenaline, if you're an adrenaline junkie, so to speak. Your dopamine goes sky high. Dopamine is a neurotransmitter that makes you feel good. We love it. We absolutely love it. Now, between you, Joe Blocks, out there, who can have a glass or two of wine and then...
Welcome to Chai with Sam Dosa. In my episode, I have a great heart-centered conversation with my guests. They are in a diverse population around the world. So enjoy and have lots of fun. Please get in touch if you'd like to be on my podcast as well. Bye for now.
Puts the bottle back in the fridge and doesn't touch the bottle for 3 days. Well, sorry, mate. Your dopamine levels, they are, yeah, rookie numbers. Mm-hmm. Me, I'm a super responder. I'm Superman as far as the release of dopamine is concerned. Give me that glass of wine. Oh boy, that dopamine is rising up to new levels. And that is the problem. We get such a buzz out of it that can be incredibly powerful. But it's that insight, learning what is happening to me in response to a certain drug, that then empowers me to actually say, okay, now I know what happens and why it happens. I know I can't do much about it, apart from actually starting to live a life where other things give me the same joy, the same dopamine, the same relief. It essentially, guys out there, it is only two things that drive us. We don't want pain and we want a reward. These are the two things, as simple as that. Don't hurt me and yes, make me happy. How that happens, ultimately, that's 9 billion people will have 9 billion different stories. But the ultimate reward and pain is the underlying thing. So therefore, if you can stay away from the pain by doing some sensible steps, and again, micro habits. These micro habits, when I'm in my book, coming back to that, the first part of my book is giving you all the facts around the alcohol, what it does to the human body, what it does to society, etc. The second part then goes through a system, the 12 steps. And that was a system that I used, that I was introduced to in my rehab. There are many other systems out there that give you a systematic approach. I just so happened to be acquainted with the 12 steps that I used. And I'm not religious. I do not believe in any deity, regardless if it is Buddha, Allah, God. But the system of the 12 steps is a practical system, how you stepwise go about exploring your emotions, exploring what is happening in you, and then changing your behavior. That is what it really is. Yes, you can sprinkle a bit of God and religion on it if you like, or you just don't use the God at all. God, when we say, when we do a prayer to God, God can also be a group of orderly drunks, G-O-D. So for those of you who can't stand the deity God, well, no biggie, okay? And I'll explain all that in the book. So that's sort of the second part of the book. And then the other really big part thereafter is, how do you deal with the challenges? Because you don't like the pain. Well, let's take that for granted, okay? So how can you avoid the pain? Again, by micro habits. By systematically acknowledging that if you're in a relationship, you can't just always take. It's the emotional bank account. You actually have to give. So maybe you have been behaving like a dick for the better part of your drinking career. How about now doing just something nice, like just sitting with your partner and listen? You don't need to say anything. You don't need to do anything. Just actually be there for your partner, which will probably put a very strange new aspect to your relationship, because as alcoholics or as addicts, we don't really do that. We are so self-centered. We matter. No one else matters. The moment you actually are there for your children and are there for your partner and are there for maybe someone who you would have otherwise not given the time of day. Wow. Suddenly that is changing you, and people see that you're changing. So you're making living amends. So you don't talk the talk, you actually walk the walk. And that's incredibly beautiful, incredibly powerful. So these are the kind of things that I talk about. So we've discussed, we want satisfaction and beautiful things, etc. But we want really serenity and peace in ourselves, which means we don't want pain. So if you know that a relationship was in the fritz, well, try to mend the relationship. If you know that finances are really, really bad, then address the finances. See if you can sell something. See if you can, your hobby, maybe you can make a few bucks out of that. You might be quite a nice photographer who enjoyed that. Well, see if you can sell some of your pictures, either as artwork or to some of the stock libraries, things like that. Think outside of the box and address the issue that predictably will give you pain. So that might be the loss of job. You can't do anything about the loss of job. You have lost your job.
Yeah.
But, okay, where to from here? Yes, you can, of course, have another bottle of whatever down the gullet. Or you could actually think, okay, today I want to feel sorry for myself. Today I want to lie here in the fetal position. I want to cry. Take that time out. That's a mental health thing. You just take that time. But tomorrow you get up again at 8 and not at lunchtime. You get up at 8 and think, okay, fine. We need immediate money. Can I get that from somewhere? We need to talk to people because they want money from us. So they need to know that, look, at the moment it's tight. So you're proactive, you communicate, etc. So these are the things. So you address those things that will hurt you and work as good as you can with them and do everything you can. And then maybe accept that there are certain things you can't do anything about.
I think there are a lot of things which you have mentioned about your book and about a lot of things. There are a lot of things that's to be understood from a completely different dimension as well. Because when we talk about addiction and when you talk about several other things, one has to start somewhere, first of all, because then also has to understand that you have to shift around you who you accompany. Because as you said, if you have all those people who has always been there to pull you down, you are not going to rise above from that sort of thing. So
no.
Everything has to shift, as well as this, as well as this micro habits, which is going to be looked after every day, whether again gratitude has there and mindfulness is there, and then every small habit to pay your gratitude that you are still alive and breathing and seeing and walking and touching and smelling and also so those sort of things require for you. But one thing which I would like to add over here is, from what I heard from you, is what sort of surrounding one person has to have that to come out from that dark place. Because you had your wife who supported you, correct? There are a lot of people. My mom did a suicide, and even though she was surrounded by children and she was not surrounded by her husband, because her husband passed away 2 years ago prior to that, but she still did a suicide. That was shocking for us, because we thought everything was fine, because my mom was, but she was in a completely different dimension at that time. We were not aware of it, because I was busy here in the UK. My brothers were busy in their own life in Pakistan. So it was completely different. And that's what we think about it, that how a person who is surrounded by the right people, but still not in the right space, what we think as outsider, that we are doing everything, correct? So how can a person can surround themselves or come out from that sort of a dark space to come in a place where people will give them some greater directions.
And you've absolutely nailed it there. That is the $100,000 question, because when you are in such a bad state, you can't actually see it. Is certainly I was in the darkest of all states, and there were many a times that I thought about suicide. It could have very easily ended up there, and it is hard for people who are in there to get out of that feeling. I think it is a very powerful thing if you are acknowledging that not everyone can be always at their best mood, to actually make it acceptable that you're down, that you're out, that you're depressed, to take the stigma away, to speak openly about mental health issues such as addiction, such as depression, such as PTSD, to make sure that people understand, for example, with depression, that one in three people in their lifetime will have a major depressive episode. And if you're a chronic pain patient, that might be one in two patients will have that. If you look at what our parents have gone through when they were younger, that can be quite scary, and we have no idea. That might be sexual abuse as a child. That might be prolonged suffering at the hands of well-meaning parents who basically beat the living daylights out of their children, because that's how they were taught, that this is how you show love, with discipline, those kind of things. So we all have our trauma. And I think by understanding that this is the case, that this is fact, that is a big first step. However happy someone appears. And let's look at many great comedians who took their lives. Mm-hmm. On the outside, you have got the most brilliant and funny and gorgeous person, and deep inside they are dying. And that is the fact. Only because someone smiles at you means absolutely nothing. That is their mask. That is their what they want you to see. And I think the skill of you, if you start to listen to people or observe people more closely, if you take away the focus from yourself to just listening to someone, suddenly you will pick up certain cues, you will see certain things. And that then is your opening. That then it might be that you say, not, I don't know, it's hard to start such conversations because they're incredibly difficult, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah.
But it is, I would start something like that and would say, well, you know, I've been so lonesome and felt so helpless. It was really, really hard for me to live and to find any enjoyment whatsoever. I would say something along these lines, and you might very well find that the other person suddenly sparks up and starts listening, and you see that recognition in their eyes. Oh, wow, you too. It's that kind of thing. So I think destigmatization, being open about mental health, and showing that you have been there where this person maybe right now is. I was in a deep, dark depression. I was suicidal. I was addicted. I was rock bottom. But to actually show that you can get out, and that suicide is a permanent solution to a temporary problem, to bring that home is such an important, important thing.
Absolutely, because a lot of things you have captured over there, and there are things which is, again, we're looking at the emotional intelligence side of one person, or how they are understanding their own self. And once one of my mentees said to me, Sam, you know, vulnerability is quite a significant thing But when you show your vulnerability, other people look at you and says, wow, man, that person has that tenacity to show themselves vulnerable. Because we are having a facade on us and we are wearing those masks all the time. Absolutely. As you said, a lot of our comedian who did a suicide, and they were comedians, they were make us laugh, but behind the scene, there were a lot of things happening. And we heard about a lot of film stars, the celebrities and all those people who come on the media as something like a very powerful gurus and everything, and we heard about them later on that they have killed themselves. So it becomes it opens up, because mental health wasn't open up in UK. I will say it is more in the spotlight for last 3 years. There was nothing being talked, and within our own society, within Asian society, I would say this is still a dogma. We'll say, oh, no, you don't talk about it, mate. This is nothing, you know. You should be doing this, you should be doing that. And when I remember, I was talking to this elderly man. I didn't go to a doctor at that time. I was a very young man as well myself. And my mom was going through with this ups and downs in her behavior. And this only I picked it up at that time. And I said to her, why don't you do prayers? And we were always been told, anything happens, go for prayers. Do the prayers, go to prayers. And this is perfectly good because we are connecting with that vibration of solace and contentment and all sorts of things, which is perfectly fine. Then I went to this guy, and this guy, this is exactly the same thing. Oh, go tell your mom to do prayers. So I convey the message. And because you are naive, you are not understanding at that time. Now I'm in the maturity of that thing. And when I speak about my mom's suicide and I open up those jars of worms, can of worms, and then it started people looking at them and say, my God, man, really? And they feel comfortable talking about their own journeys. A lot of bereavement, or people who go for bereavement, they do not do that bereavement correctly, or they are not being guided correctly. And they find it very difficult to overcome those losses because there are so much attachment, because they haven't had any other opportunity to knowing themselves first. Because we go through with certain aspect of our life, my childhood being completely different, and I gone through with my own journeys as well. But what I look at in life right now, in this present moment, is I want to live in the present. Neither in the past, neither in the future, because I haven't got a clue what future lies for me. If I'll make my present beautiful, my future will become better.
Very true, Sam. Very true. I think it is really, really hard, certainly in the Asian cultures. There is alcoholism, etc., is a taboo. If you take a look at the Sikh culture, for example, everyone needs to be looking perfect. That's the reason that Bollywood is such a phenomenal success there. And my goodness, you never, ever, ever admit that something could possibly be wrong. Yet, if you look at Sikh in the UK, 1 in 4 drink heavy-duty alcohol. Okay, so you're talking actually about taboos that are constantly being broken, but no one wants to talk about it. And that is where only in recent years people have come out and actually spoke out about their own mental health struggles, and suddenly it became more acceptable amongst the younger Sikh to talk openly about their problems. And it's the emotions, it's the underlying emotions again and again that you need to address. When I went into rehab, the most dreaded moment of the day, the hour of the day, was 10 o'clock in the morning, emotions. That's what the lecture was called. And it was not a lecture. You're sitting around a circle on your chairs. No one is allowed sunglasses. No one is allowed any head coverings, etc. No one has anything in their hands. And you only talk about your emotions. And it's so hard because you have been numbing your emotions, or you have been changing them with the drugs or with your behavior, etc. And you have not dealt with the problems, the real emotions that are driving you. You have not dealt with the trauma that has that is really the underlying problem that then leads to your worsening behavior with the addiction. And it's the emotions. If you can address that, and if you can make that, if you can live a life in which you show to your family as a good example how you deal with emotions, this is such a powerful thing. To actually look at your wife, and when she rips into you, I mean, please, that has been so common with us. And my wife was like, they're really, really hitting me, kind of with her words, hurting me. And nowadays, let's say two, three years, I've learned, we don't have that anymore. But let's say 2, 3 years ago, she would have been incredibly angry with me. And I would have just stood back and let her talk for a bit and then try to figure out, look, honey, what's really going on? What do you mean? Well, what is really bothering you? It is not that I have come home a bit late here. That doesn't matter whatsoever. What's really going on? Oh, well, these finances, it drives me nuts. Or the kids have driven me nuts, or those kind of things. So suddenly to actually not respond with anger to anger, but actually see the anger as a distress signal and listening and maybe reframing it a bit, repackaging a bit, handing the mirror, or sort of holding the mirror in front of her face in a nice way and say, look, you know, tell you what, why don't we have a cup of tea together? And why don't we sit down and let's talk about these finances? If they're so scary for you at the moment, what's really going on? And suddenly that fight is over. Whilst in the old times, my goodness, I would have been under influence. She shouts at me, how dare you? You disrespect me. And the anger comes back out and we would have had a huge row. Nowadays, we don't row anymore.
No.
Because we actually have recognized that, hang on, what is really going on here? We both stop, analyze the situation, and maybe we are both in a really bad, bad, bad mood. And then we just leave, and one goes going to one room and the other one to the other room. 10 minutes, 30 minutes later, we come back, kiss each other, and that's it. So this is the emotions, that you figure out what is really going on. And that needs to be done openly, honestly, with humility and with your ears far more than with your mouth. Okay, you need to listen. You've got two ears, one mouth. You should use it in exactly that ratio. And suddenly your life changes quite a bit.
Absolutely, absolutely. You nailed it over there. And I was going to talk about a lot of other things as well about a husband and wife or partners and how everything escalates. And there's one question in my questionnaire of emotional intelligence where I ask a husband and wife having a fight, and in the row they started having a very high pitch where they started calling upon their families and everything. And there were four suggestions, were the first one was that you take a 20 minute break. You go for, you actually refocus, regroup yourself and start talking about the same thing. Or you keep silent, nothing happened, kissy, kissy, and then go to sleep. And then the third one is, the fourth one was extremely out of the context. So everybody on my LinkedIn, everybody started putting A, B, C, D, or I will have an A first and then C or D, and after that. And so I did this questionnaire in Pakistan, and majority of women said to me, I would be silent. I won't say anything to my husband. And I was, for me, it was because I was been living in the UK for last 18 years. And I says, why? Oh no, but I can't actually raise my voice in front of my husband. That's disrespectful. That's how everything has been embedded in them by their parents, that you do not disrespect your husband. Your husband is your God. You respect your husband, whether he will kick you, hurt you emotionally, physically, you just respect him. So there are a lot of things in the cultures and how the culture is setting as well. Another thing which I wanted to add over here, when we talk about emotions, it's not about those emotions, which every emotion has a significant effect on your body, on your system. As the more we suppress, the more it becomes chronic in your body, and that creates so many different triggers in your life as well. And then when you talk about emotions in a ladies, let's say for example, a woman have emotions which she can take it out, talk to her friends, her girl's friends, and then she go and all the women talk, they talk about, and they also talk about their husbands or their boyfriends and this and that, and they take this whole thing out. But as a man, we suppress everything in our body. Keep it in our body because we do not have the vent out of venting it out. That's what I said a lot of my clients. This is better than out. It's better out than in. Take it out, mate. You know, keep it. Because we men suffer more problems going forward in life than women. And that's the irony of our journey. Because we are being told from the childhood, be a man. Be a man. Don't be a sissy. Don't be a this. Don't be a that. So we are keeping all those emotions in our body and thinking, you know, I can take care of everything. Even inside, you are completely wrecking yourself. You can't stand a chance. Yes.
But then again, let me, to those folks out there who have been brought up in that ideal, I want you to look at some real hard men, special forces soldiers. Special forces soldiers or soldiers that are out there fighting wars and are really, really, I mean, they are men, you have to admit that. What have we found out? That if they can debrief in the right way, their chance of PTSD, of post-traumatic stress disorder, is much, much reduced. There was, for example, the Falkland Wars between the UK and Argentina. And as it so happened, it was a very short war, 6 weeks or thereabouts, and a lot of nasty things happened in that war. So the English soldiers lost their friends, lost their brothers. When the war was finished, they all got repatriated back to the UK. Some of them ended up on an aeroplane and were going home basically within 2 days. They were back on UK soil. Others were brought home on the troop transporters, on the ships. Now, if you compare these two groups, same soldiers, same gory experiences, same trauma, but the amount of PTSD in the people who came home on the ship was tremendously reduced compared with those that immediately got back. Because what happened? These guys were talking to their mates on the way home, on the ship. There was time to debrief. There was time for them. If they wanted to, they could lie in their bunk bed and just cry and get it out of their system and then talk to others. It was normal to go around to other groups and just talk and talk and talk and actually work out these emotions. And that was a inadvertent, double-blinded kind a research, so to speak. Not that it was intended, but it so happened to be. And that was when people started to pay attention to what is needed to talk about your emotions. Because the emotions are there, like it or lump it. There is survivor guilt. There is the fear. You have been surviving, maybe barely surviving, when around you people have died and you constantly relive the trauma. You constantly are reminded of these things. Your dreams are circling around the same topic. You're hypervigilant. You're constantly aroused, and not in a sexual way, but in a kind of, so that is PTSD, what I'm describing here. Now, with these soldiers, it's well known, the shell shock out of the First World War, and then in many following wars, we know about the PTSD. What people don't realize is you don't have to fight a war to have PTSD. If you have a major road traffic accident, then your chance of having a PTSD is probably 1 in 3, 1 in 4, thereabouts. Mm-hmm. So it is these kind of constant mental health challenges can be there, and you might not even recognize them for what they are. Yet you are constantly on the edge. You're constantly uncomfortable. And, well, what better to do than having a glass of something to steady your nerves, or take a sleeping pill? And before you know it, you take every day a sleeping pill, and you're becoming quite addicted to that, because without that, you have to deal with your emotions. But you don't know you have to deal with your emotions, because it's all flying underneath the radar. You actually don't know what is going on. So it is so, so important. Again, this talking and being open about your emotions, that is so important, especially for us men, because you're right, Sam, we want to keep it all inside. We are men, real men. Bullshit. We are men, and therefore we are specifically at risk of suffering from depression, of putting such a huge pedestal up, and which we want to stand upon, that we set ourselves up to fail. We are demanding so much from us. You have to be the perfect lover, the perfect husband, the perfect breadwinner, the perfect neighbor, the perfect everything perfect. And on Facebook, it has to look just nice. And your Instagram needs to be just right with the nice, manly picture. Oh, for crying out loud. Okay.
Simon, that was a great conversation. And thank you very much for being my guest today on Chai with Sam Dosa. I think what Simon has shared in this podcast is quite eye-opening. And I would really, really want people to get in touch with Simon. If you are going through with some sort of addiction, not only alcoholic addiction, even though that is the biggest addiction as we call upon because of this COVID-19, a lot of people have actually drawn to that because that gives them a completely numbing feelings and everything. And that's where, you know, we need to go and talk to your people, talk to those who actually understand you and know you and actually trust you and you trust them. And then it's better to talk instead of keeping your emotion inside. And I will highly, highly say, if you are going through with that challenges, please get in touch with some professional. If you don't find a professional, I would suggest you can talk to me or talk to Stefan. He is available. It can be available to you to talk to him. I will put all his information in the description of this podcast. So do not despair yourself. Life is very precious. And remember, we all go through with uncertainty in our life. If somebody is there to help you, ask for help. If you don't ask, you will not get. So remember this mantra. I said to my children, I said to everybody, if you don't ask, you will not get. So make sure that you ask. And whoever you pray to, constantly ask. Ask, ask, ask. And then you will definitely get it. So thank you very much, Stefan, for being my guest today. Thank you.
It was an absolute honor. Thank you very much, Sam, for making time for me and asking me all the right questions so that I can show some of my enthusiasm and my passion for living a beautiful, beautiful life. And you guys out there, you have deserved this beautiful life. Find out, ask the right questions, and find out how you can achieve that.
Thank you.